This is HPR episode 2371 entitled HPR Community News for August 2017 and is part of the series HPR Community News. It is hosted by HPR volunteers and is about 88 minutes long and carries an explicit flag. The summary is HPR volunteers talk about shows released and comments posted in August 2017.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Hi everybody, my name is Ken Fallon and you're listening to another exciting episode of Hacker Public Radio Community News. This time, we're doing it for the month of August 2017. Joining me tonight is JWP. Say hi, JWP.
Hi everyone, how are y'all?
And from Bonnie, Scotland, it's Dave Morris.
Hello, I tried the fake Scottish accent, but I'll not bother this time.
It's very similar to your fake Irish accent, Dave.
Miss it. All my accents are fake.
Well, anyway, for those of us who, for a lot of you probably joining for the first time due to the fact that we got nominated for the podcast awards in the tech section. So we're shortlisted down to 10. There's no requirement on anyone to vote this year. A team of illustrious volunteers will be doing that for us. So that's probably going to bring quite a few people in to try and figure out what is going on over here with this thing that we call Hacker Public Radio. And just so you know, it's a community podcast that, and by that we mean the shows themselves are produced by the community. Think of it as a sort of bar camp thing where every day somebody walks up and submits in a show, and you can pick the show that you want to do. And if you're thinking, well, I've always wanted to get into podcasting, but I have no idea what to talk about, a very good first show that you can do is tell us who you are, where you come from, and how you got into tech. Plenty of people, over 200 and something, pushing 300 people, have already done this. So absolutely something that anybody can do. One of the things that we like to make sure here is that every single show gets commented on. And in order to do that, we dedicate one show a month. The first show, what's the rule there, Dave, for the first show?
First Monday of the month is when we put it out.
That's right. First Monday of the month, which makes it very complicated to figure out when exactly we're recording it. But we record it 2 days before that on the Saturday. And anyone is welcome to join and just shoot the breeze. If you're wondering who we are just people who were suckered into into helping out with the administration. And by administration, we mean janitorial work here at Hacker Public Radio. The community itself makes all the decisions on the way we go. And the way we go is determined on the mailing list. So if you're not on the mailing list, please feel free to join that. And we thank our kind sponsors from anhonesthost.com and the Internet Archive for doing all the hosting of the show. And we thank the other individuals associated with in the background who provide gratis and free individual services like domain name registration and various things like that. So, long story short, what we do here at this roundup is we go through the shows that there have been in the last month. We also will be going through the comments that people have made on those shows. And we will be talking about stuff that went on in the mailing list and bringing to your attention anything that will be policy related here on HPR. So, without further ado, the man of the moment, JWP himself is right here, and he had the honor of having the first show for this month, and it was an introduction to Apache Hadoop. just a pretty boring summary of Hadoop and how it works. Dave, what did you think of this?
Well, I thought John's JWP was going to jump in there, but no, I'm interested in Hadoop, and I was glad to hear this to get me deeper into it. But I'm not sure what I need it for, but I'm sure I do need it somewhere or other. But yeah, it was good.
I used to work in a place where this will be very useful, possibly in the future, but it's a good one to know about. I would love to have the kit to be able to run this.
Yes.
If there was only somebody working who would be able to ship us servers without anybody knowing.
Oh, yes, JWP. Yes. Hint.
And that's it's all about money, man.
It is indeed. It's all about the base. So, no, actually, that was quite good. And you've done a whole series on this, and I'm looking forward to the next ones coming up. The following day, we had Vim Hints by Dave Morris. And folks listening along, no, you don't have to come on here every if your show has been posted this month. It just happens to be the first two shows.
Quite surprising, yeah, yeah. We should get people who have done shows not to be on. No, that wouldn't work, would it?
No.
But yeah. Yes. So yeah,
as always, Dave. I thought the Vim Hints series was dead. Oh, by the way, we do series as well. So if you have a topic that is too detailed to go through in one show, you can always make a series out of it. If you submit three shows in that series, then it becomes a series. Go ahead, Dave.
Yes, I wasn't sure whether anybody was particularly interested in learning more about Vim, but I did get a little teeny bit of positive feedback, so I thought I would resurrect this one after a couple of years of sitting in the doldrums.
Yeah, well, Vim is the sort of thing that doesn't get old.
Well, I just go on the basis that if somebody had done this and I'd heard this before I started playing with Vim, I would have been delighted to have this sort of introduction. So hopefully somebody out there is finding it useful.
And that's the, again, I've said it before about the HPR, and I'll say it again, is that fame and fortune, you're very unlikely to get over here, but you will get the undying gratitude of some poor sucker who has just found a particular show meeting his or her or their needs. And that is, you may never meet those people. Those people may forget even to comment back, which they should do, or send an email and thanks. And that's why we do it, folks. So the next day we had customizing my bash prompt, which was a detailed look into how and why to customize a bash prompt. And this is by Windigo. And I did at one time go absolutely nuts customizing my bash prompt and then stopped doing that.
Yep. Same here. I don't know. I think at one point I did sort of multi-line prompts and stuff with colors and that sort of stuff when it became available because it seemed so cool. But it just got to be a slight nuisance, really. I just wanted to get on with stuff rather than having colored things. However, if I'd thought of doing what Windigo has done, I think I might have considered it otherwise because these are really clever.
Yeah, the Git thing is quite cool.
Yeah.
Do you do any customization there, John?
It got really over my head pretty quick when he started talking about everything. But I went and I started playing with my bash prompt and everything, and I always have a hard time because my computer name is so long, and so I always like to change it to a shorter name in a bash prompt.
Yeah, that's good as reason as any to do it, I guess. There has been a lot of comments on this. X1101 is, although I can't help but think that should be 1101. Prompt for other users. Windigo, loved your episode. Very well appreciated. I had one thought. When you want to run your prompt as another user, or have another user-specific prompts, you don't need to do any symlinking, especially on the multi-user system. For example, on the servers I helped manage, I had a .root bash rc in my home directory, and after I did sudo space su dash to get a root shell, I would then source /home/x1101./.root/bash rc to get my root specific RC file. Just some food for thought. Basically, he was running a bash script that would do his own manipulation. To which Windigo replies.
So Windigo says, quick follow-up. Zoke was kind enough to remind me that I hadn't posted a link anywhere to my configurations. Here's the Git repository, and he gives a URL of it.
Yeah, you put that into the show notes.
I actually added that in, yes, yes. I can't remember. Did I annotate it or not? I can't remember.
Yeah, linky and everything.
Yep. And he says to X1101.
And the third comment.
I haven't finished the second one yet. Eureka, man. That makes a lot more sense, especially on multi-user systems, since you wouldn't want to steamroll other users' RC files with your own. Thanks for the tip, man, he says. So go ahead.
Okay, so comment three is by you, Dave. And you said, great show, most enjoyable. I enjoyed it too, Dave. Thanks for doing the show. I enjoyed it a lot, even though I'm rather late listening to it. I have done stuff to my prompts in the past on Unix systems and on Linux, but have just not bothered in latter years. I like the ideas you talk about here and may well have inspired me to experiment some more.
Okay, the next day was Ahuka's insurance, Ahuka's series on insurance, understanding the marketplace, how the healthcare insurance market works in the US. And this one was about, yeah, the principles that govern the marketplace in this episode. And Canadian Bob says, health insurance market. As a Canadian, most of my fellow citizens find the idea of healthcare being a marketplace a little bit weird. Universal Medicare became a reality in the province of Saskatchewan in 1962. By 1971, piece by piece, it had become a national program. Now the move is towards expanding into universal pharmacare, one of the missing pieces of our universal Medicare system.
Kevin O'Brien says, that's why I recorded this. I know that the American system does not make sense to most people outside the US, or frankly, to most people inside the US. So I thought it was worth a little of my time to lay it out.
And we do appreciate that. Yes, indeed, we do.
I thought it was pretty good. He covered it really, really well, and it was entirely interesting to me because I have a lot of brothers and sisters, and they're at both ends of the spectrum. One doesn't pays the Obamacare fine because he doesn't want any insurance, and the other one goes to the marketplace and buys, and it's a bunch of in between. Although I hope one day we'll have single payer insurance just like everybody else.
So the following day we had this community news show. Murphy is strong, but Ken struggles on just barely. Everything that could possibly go wrong went wrong doing that episode.
yeah. And congratulations on making it through.
Oh, I had to even edit it, and it was just a mess, complete mess. And Mad Sweeney says, Shanos free software song made me happy. That's a Fiaco all the winner right there. Thanks. Which Mad Sweeney, you also show my friend, for a start.
That's kudos for you. That's very good. So Crayon says, do you want to do this one, JWP? Sorry.
Just a second. I
thought I heard you in the background. It's okay. I'll do it. You want to do it or not?
20 comments.
There's only two. Dave, go on ahead.
Crayon says, amazing free software song. Ken, damn, that's the best rendition of the free software I've ever heard. Loved it. Smiley face.
I suspect sarcasm is... is truly off of every port.
Still a good comment.
Anyway, tune in to the end of this show to find out what the hell all that's about. The following day, we had a continuation of the Liverpool MakerFest 2017 show 5, where short series of interviews done from Liverpool MakerFest. And this is something that we do here on the network. We specialize in getting the hallway track at festivals. So if you're going to a Linux Fest or a Hacker Fest or a Maker Fest or something cool in general where there are a lot of people walking around, bring a microphone with you or press the recorder on your mobile phone, stick it under somebody interesting's nose and say, hey, what are you doing here? And submit that as a show. Tony's been very good doing that. He's got LiverpoolMakerFest.org, 3D Meld, and Electric Flapjack Guitars, which is a pity we wasn't able to donate one of them to us, alas.
Well, Ken, I walked around the Aug Camp this year, and every good show that I saw, I reminded them that they needed to do it for a show for us.
you were at Dog Camp and you didn't record shows.
I did not record GWP, shows, but I did
into
talk
the corner
to them about
and think about what you've done.
I talked to them about it, man. I talked to Richard from Open Sousa and the Mozilla girl about the cryptography, and every show, everyone that I liked, I went and talked about Ken, and they all wanted Ken and Dave to be there.
Yeah, Rich is a good guy. I've interviewed him a few times at Foston. So the following day, we had Robo Thermometer and a surprisingly short, geeky episode about a temperature sensor in a Raspberry Pi. And I hated this episode, Epicanus, because this was in my queue and I hadn't recorded it. Oh, so annoying, but a good show. Very good show. I love this. I'm running it. I have two sensors on the same Pi because of the Dallas protocol. You can actually put two sensors on the same Pi. So I've got an internal one and an external one logging to the same one. And there are some comments. Be Easy said on my to-do list. There you go. Thanks for this entertaining and informative episode. I've been meaning to test out temperature monitoring on the Raspberry Pi for some time. Do you know if the P process you described will work with one wire temperature probes as shown below?
And Claudio M says, another great episode. Even with all those dry robotic commands and regex, you always find a way to make things interesting and entertaining to listen to. Thanks again for another great episode and welcome back.
And just an answer to Be Easy, just an answer to your question there, that is the external probe that I'm using here. Yes, so it should work. Asterix, don't blame me if it doesn't.
Okay, so comment three, or did we do comment three yet?
No, go, all yours.
Okay, it says Epikins Priviaki, a pseudonym, said he was glad to be back, and he has at BZI, looks like exactly the sort of submersible temperature sensor that would work. It's exactly the same core component as far as the Raspberry Pi is concerned. They just stuck to it. A heating conduit piece of stainless steel and sealed it up so that it could be submerged into whatever liquid, potentially wet weather, etc., you might want to monitor. From what I read, you'll need a 4.7 ohm resistor between the two of those leads. The module I'm using has parentheses one, has a built into the board already, but otherwise you should be able to plug it in, right in, and use exactly as described. At Claudio M, thanks for encouraging feedback. I swear I'm really trying to produce much more often than I have been. Probably more short episodes coming real soon now. Okay, and then in parentheses one, amazon.com /DP, and then a weird long number.
The resistor is only necessary, one resistor is only necessary in the chain. So if you've got a daisy chain of several of these, you only need the resistor in once. So then you can daisy chain the rest off that. I put it in as some heat shrink at the point closest to the GPIO port.
Very cool. Yeah, good show. I enjoyed this.
Very nice. But he has now taken the last person who does that to me all the time is Klaatu, putting in shows that I have on my to-do list. You know what the moral of the story is? Record the shows and send them in first.
Don't just think about them, do them.
Yeah, exactly. And there's absolutely no reason why you can't submit a show on the same topic, because I imagine that mine will be of interest to somebody as well at some point. So the following day, we had Night Sounds in Rural Tennessee, a recording of night sounds outside Tullahoma, Tennessee. And we do need a name for this type of series, Dave.
We used the term sound seeing when we talked about this before. We should make a series with that name that people can attach to. It's sound seeing. I think
night sounds. I don't really like night sounds.
But people make recordings of sounds in an environment to give some sort of a sound picture of what's going on. That's the sort of series name we need for this type of thing. Sound seeing's a thing we decided on, I think.
Okay. I think we might be losing something in the translation, because when I read the title, Night Sounds in Rural Tennessee, I knew exactly what he was talking about and from the beginning. But Dave, what you say for your title, it's not exactly clear.
No, it's not the title of this episode. It's the title of, we want to make a series where we can put this show and other shows. So we have shows, for example, of people walking in the rain, binaural recordings of going to work, swimming in a lake in France, swimming in, down a river in France, 5150 snoring, that sort of stuff. So yeah. I think soundscapes will be good.
Yeah. We talked briefly about it, but we'd never decided on anything and never got on and did anything. So this is something for the to-do list.
Indeed. Do you want to read your comment, Dave?
In
your
own words? Said, some impressive ambient sounds. Thanks, John. Great idea for a show. I'd love to know more about what was making these sounds, cicadas, as you said. But what else, I wonder, because it sounded like to me there were frogs or birds or something. I haven't personally encountered anything quite like those night sounds here in not very rural Scotland. You'd hear owls or foxes, but not a lot else in my experience.
Tony says, wow. That was really loud but fascinating. I recorded some wildlife birdsong while at a study centre in Birmingham in the UK last April. It's quite long, at over 10 minutes, but very relaxing. Maybe there's another show. Yes, there is. And now we have the Soundscape series in which to put it in.
In comment three, Frank mentioned that this reminded me of night sounds at Pine View Farm when I was growing up.
And Jonathan replied with Mystery Bug. Thanks for the comments, everyone. Dave, I had no idea what else is out there making all this noise. A biologist specializing in insects can probably make some sense of it. But to me, it's just a bunch of wonderful noise.
Windigo says more nostalgia. I agree with Frank. Noises like this were a common occurrence where I was while I was growing up. This episode brought back lots of warm memories. Thanks a bunch, John.
I would like to comment here that when I went to Kansas City the very first time as a youth, and the guys brought me out to a restaurant, and I walked past in a car park, just a piece of landscaping, and there was all these sort of insects there, and the guys were walking past like nothing was happening, and I spent 10 minutes just sitting listening to this stuff because I had only ever heard of it in the movies and never actually realized it was insects making it, always assumed it was some sort of weird sound effect or other.
Yes, I've actually heard them in Australia. There's a day cicada in Australia, but I didn't realize that they only sang at night in many other parts of the world. So there's a lot to learn.
In Houston, an evening thing.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, evening or nighttime, I guess, isn't it? Very, very good.
I wonder, though, would you guess, if you were not used to it, would it drive you nuts?
It might be one of those things that you just tune out. I don't know, you know, if you live with it long enough. But it take a while before you get there, I guess.
My wife, when she first went to the States, she asked me what that was, and I found it, and I threw it at her, and I got in trouble.
I think I found it and threw it at her. Did he just say that he picked up one and threw it at her? Yes, of course she got in trouble with JWB.
She didn't know what it was, and I told her it was poisonous, and she started doing the death shake.
Why did she marry you? Seriously.
Those are big things, those cicadas. They're not. They're quite ugly, too.
She also didn't know what a cricket was, and I told her when we were walking across the dam that they were flesh-eating and they weren't supposed to get on her. It just got worse and worse the whole visit to the States.
You're a cruel man.
Yeah, very, very cruel. The
I
following
just couldn't
day,
that somebody didn't know what crickets were. What crickets were? It was like really. Like,
we don't.
You
have
didn't
weird
spend any time outside
here
as a child. But you should have seen me trying to discover the casinos this summer. I'd never been in a casino really before, and so we drove from Texas to Florida and through Louisiana, Mississippi. We stopped at the casinos, and I'd never been in one, and she had, so she got me back.
And only rightly so. Okay, the following day, we and Wii U software modding, which by operator, this is something that I didn't even think was possible, but quite interesting nonetheless.
Yeah, I know nothing about this. I bet my kids do, but it's a closed book to me, I'm afraid.
And there were no comments on that. The following day, we had safely enabling SSH for the default Raspbian image by myself. And Tlatu says, good coffee. That sounds like some good coffee.
So you had a break for coffee.
Ken, I had some questions about that. Now, was that with the new Pixel? Because Ben was at the Og Camp, and he was talking about the new Pixel from Raspbian. That's what they're calling their new distribution. Actually, I think it was Pixel, and then they changed the name to something else. But he was talking about. So this is for the latest version, Ken?
Yeah, latest version. You just run the script, it downloads it, unpacks it, fixes the thing, and zips it right back up.
And they have an x86 now for that too. That he said it would probably work on a 4 gigabyte SSD.
Yeah, don't think so. I think you need an 8. It just goes over. It's about 4 point something. So it's just pushing over.
On the x86 version.
Oh, okay. Yeah, fair enough.
This was great, though. I'm desperate to try it. I haven't got an opportunity yet, but it's good.
This was months in the making and months thinking about, because it's part of a longer plan, because we've got a lot of pies in work, so I really don't want to be putting them out and putting them back in. And was this the SD card that I did before work, and this the one after work? And so there's another show coming up related to this, and then maybe I'll branch off into something else.
You mentioned Ansible Chef and Puppet and stuff like that, so
yep.
I assume these will figure large on your plan. I'd like to hear more about that.
Well, the next one in the series is how to identify Raspberry Pis on your network. So the point about this is you just run this, it'll download the image, and then at the end of it, you'll have an image that you can put into your Pi, and then you boot your Pi up. So the Pi will get an IP address from some DHCP server. So the point you want to be able to do then is on an Ansible, you have one master Pi that you're controlling, that you have a keyboard, screen, and mouse in, and maybe you have DHCP on that, maybe not. But then that guy needs to be able to go out and go find me all the Pis on my network. So it'll go and do that based on MAC addresses, and then it'll put that into the Ansible host file. And then once you've done that, then because we now have the key and everything already configured over there, you can start using Ansible to do a distro update, secure all your stuff. And because it's, because the scripts run and converge on a single fix, then you have everything that you need to run on that one single thing. So that's part of my greater plan.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool.
So the next one was Airsoft, by Operator. Airsoft Mini How To. I talk about my current Airsoft setup and what we should all do as hobbyists. And this is a perfect example of a show that you don't think you're going to be interested in. And then I ended up spending some time in Ireland with a friend of mine's getting married. So we were over there shooting the breeze. And his son was big into Airsoft. And we had a very pleasant conversation. And I pointed him to this very show about the topic.
It really brought back some memories for me. Until very recently, I did the Army, and so you only get to shoot one time a year, and it's all about the positions that you have to get into. So you have to get into 7 or 8 different positions, and so I went and bought a Airsoft weapon that was an exact replica of what the Army uses, and I practiced the positions with the Airsoft. And so that's my experience with Airsoft. And it was same weight, same everything. And so I was able to go through the positions and do the exercises and everything. And then as soon as I retired, I sold it to the guy that replaced me. He was into that immediately.
So, yeah, very good.
So,
very cool. I was just thrown by the fact they're called Airsoft and they can draw blood if you don't have protective clothing on.
Well, in comparison with what they're replacing, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The following day, we had the Amateur Radio Roundtable number 2, various different hosts by Steve and Michael. And this was very, very interesting. I have a whole go of basically a lot of clarification on the questions that they were posed on the first show. So quite good. I've been thinking about propagation and stuff, wavelength, the Doppler effect and stuff, and they explained it quite nicely. So yeah. I thought they did
a great job, actually. I've always been a little bit wary of the amateur radio thing because it seemed very, very obscure, and I wasn't quite sure it was something for me. I'm still not sure, but I was impressed at how friendly and welcoming the atmosphere of their show was. You know, you felt that if you did want to get into it, people like them would be very, very helpful to get you there. You know,
forgiving,
not things to be scared of. Yeah. So I thought from that point of view it was excellent. Plus, also it's technically brilliant. I thought it was very well done. Some of those explanations helped a lot.
Okay. The next show was Android, ROM, and Pain by Operator. I go over my pain and love of Android over the last few years, and I get his pain, so I do.
Well, I thought it was such an interesting one, Ken. I mean, first off, the Operator guy, which we should probably agree that we should buy him a beer when one of us meets him, because he's really knocked himself out this month with all the podcasts he did.
Yeah.
But I always have the, you know, I go to the Lineage and I look and it's like the only tablet that I see is an Avita Shield and I think one from Asus. So, and my phones are never on the list from those phones that they're talking about. I think I could do it with a Kindle, a Fire Kindle tablet or something, but it's not an official supported one by the Lineage, so it's really hard for me to find the right device. So it's I wish that something was universal, that it was like a x86 computer and I just installed Linux, but it's not that way.
No,
it's
no.
quite difficult.
I had Steve McLaughlin and what's the name? Hold on. Who else is on? Steve McLaughlin and Super Coop. Yep, that's him. Cody Cooper. From Linux for the Rest of Us, from Podnuts Network. They have been very helpful with me deciding on a device to pick for unrooted devices. So I may or may not. I've got a replacement phone for my wife just on the counter there charging, so possibly there'll be another show or possibly it won't work out, so we'll see. But you might want to ping them. They have some very good shows over there on the Podnuts Network in related to all this stuff, so listen to their shows and you might get good recommendations for a product that you'll be able to buy.
Yeah, I'll try to do that. I mean, I almost pulled the plug that the Robin phone, the one that did the cloud storage, they went out of business, but they have an official Lineage OS, and you can get those on eBay now for 105 euros delivered. And so with 32 gigabyte of space and 3 gigabytes of main memory. So there is one there that I saw that I could get, but I'm really looking for something in the, I don't know, 50 or 60 euro range that will work with Lineage so that I can give it a try, you know?
Yeah, but you're going to get a very, very, unless you get a secondhand product.
That's what I'm looking for. Yeah. It's probably okay. Secondhand somewhere, yeah.
So the following day, we had the next one, Financing Healthcare Means Choices to be Made, Trade-offs of the U.S. Healthcare System. And this was basically how there is no free launch, but you have to pay. And this was in a Hookah series. And the following episode is Information Underground Working Out by Deep Geek, Lost in Bronx, and Klaatu. And I made a comment, and to that, Claudio replied with quite a lot of links, which is an episode in itself, actually. I wonder, should we get him to submit that as a show, Dave?
Yes, I think so. I think so. Whenever a comment gets into the sort of thing that we don't necessarily want to read out because it's so long, then I think you already know that it should be a show.
Yeah, it should be. I'll just read on the last thing. Ultimately, what has worked for me, it was an evolutionary process into my fitness journeys. Everyone's different and every strategy will be different, but the core mentality process is pretty much the same. And I couldn't agree more. And I agree with his comment, and it is a very interesting read, but it would make a better show in actual fact. So we'll skip on to the next one. Were there any other comments on that?
There was a comment from Deep Geek just correcting his the cost of one of the bits of equipment, dip stand that he had. Yeah.
Yeah.
Other than that, none. So the other thing about comments is shows the comment system doesn't and probably never will honor links properly. So, you know, making a show means you can put all your links in there and they're actually usable.
Absolutely.
Yeah. A lot less so.
So the following day, we had Raspbian X86 Lenovo X61S. And this is another distribution review show by Tony Hughes. And this one has two comments. Biza said, X86 on Atom-powered netbook. Hi, Tony. After listening to your episode, I was inspired to try the Raspbian X86 on my old Acer notebook, which I use mainly as a media player. Acer ran okay with Mint XFCE, but a bit slow to respond when opening and closing programs. After a clean install of Raspbian X86 on the netbook, definitely runs a bit faster than Mint. I've stripped out all the applications I don't need, programming, games, office components. Wi-Fi worked out of the box, unlike the Lenovo, as did the audio. Pixel will never win any prize for sophistication, but if you play around with the colors, you can improve the default appearance somewhat. It certainly gets the job done. JWP, you were talking about this earlier, weren't you?
Yeah, I have to say that Tony was that of the month. This was my favorite one because Tony was going really, really great about the Raspbian thing, and then to add to it, Ben Nuttall was at he works for the Raspberry Pi folks, and he was there at the Aug Camp, and he did a talk about this Pixel. Or the Raspbian X86 there, and it's a really interesting thing, and I think especially on the low end that it's really gonna pick up.
Yeah, I was impressed with this. I've got an old Atom powered netbook as well, and wondering what on earth to do with it. And this sounds like something well worth a try.
I wonder what the Acer Aspire 1 mark can be any use with this.
I was thinking of an Asus, whatever they were called. What were they called?
EPCs. You know, I've got that 701 that I'm thinking about, right? I could fix that 701 maybe, and if I could, if it fits on 4 gigabytes. See, what they told me, the guy from the Raspberry Pi told me that it doesn't come with all the educational software, so it has a much smaller space requirement. He said that he thought that it would be 2.8 gigabytes. So
wow,
it fits on
cool.
all the old SSDs in the netbooks. So you don't have to use a USB attachment or anything like that.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Should give that a go. So the next day we had Cancelling My TV License by Dave. Dave, who hit the automated, this is so funny. So very funny.
Bureaucracy.
Not really.
You want to spit.
I don't know whether to put this down to evil corporations. I don't think so. I just don't think they would ever think that that's a use case they need to cover. And if they do, it's like, well, so few people cancel their TV license that there's no point investing the money in coding it.
I think this is something like 1.5 million people in the UK who have cancelled, according to the Wikipedia article. I think I've got the number right. Yeah, I think so. Check it out. I might have misremembered the number, but I thought it was something like that. But I you know, if you're going to build a system, you need to cater for all the possible avenues, and one of them is obviously that you can cancel, because they tell you how to do it, yet they don't seem to have implemented it, and they don't seem to have a clue how to make it work, and you know, none of the staff know what they're doing.
When faced with something like this, I'm more inclined to think of incompetency as opposed to malice.
Start
it off going, oh, this is a system where you can renew your TV license. Oh, why? For renewing our TV license, I'm going to need to have a TV license number, and I'll just make that the primary key of the database, and you know, must not be empty. And then operators are going, no license is a TV license number for the people who don't have a no license, but so that gets them past that page. But then you do a select query on no license, and 1.5 million no licenses come up, and then the thing goes, well, I have no information on you.
Well, yes. having just received another letter from them today telling me that they said, oh, your license has been cancelled. Oh my God, shock horror, you must ring us immediately because you didn't pay for it. We've cancelled it, so you better get that sorted straight away. So it's like a person with a split brain, you know. This one half of it is saying, oh, you got to pay us and you haven't paid us and terrible things are going to happen. The other half is saying, Yeah, it's fine. You haven't paid. You don't need the license. So we've got that all organized. So I'm going to have this voyage will continue. Yeah, absolutely. The voyage is going to continue.
Frank says this makes commercials look good.
Well, yes, I'll have to do a show about how they do it in Germany.
Yes, actually, that would be nice.
That would be interesting. Yeah, it's not just the UK.
So. There's two American-owned stations that do German programming, and I have to pay taxes to an American-owned corporation to watch German TV in Germany. And of course, I don't ever watch German TV, but they want these taxes from me. And I'm like, well, I speak English. I watch English shows. I don't watch German shows. They don't care. If you live in Germany and you own a device, they even go to the internet. If you get on the internet, you have to pay. So it just goes on and on and on. So
I think that's not uncommon. I suspect. I think I've heard other people saying similar things in other countries. I think it's the way the UK will go too.
I mean, the only thing worse hated is the game of people. You know, the people that in Germany that stop the YouTube videos that say, "Oh, this might be copyrighted content, and so you can't watch it on YouTube." It drives me insane.
Although that said, it would be an interesting discussion to have. Where your TV license gets transformed into a royalty license, whereby you could watch whatever the hell you wanted, and that would then be attributed to the people who are producing the shows. So if you're watching Big Clive instead, you pay your TV license, Dave, and your subscription goes, a portion of your subscription goes to Big Clive or
that would be
else.
Better. That'd be much better, Ken.
Yeah.
I like that.
I don't mind the concept of paying for stuff that I like. I mean, I support Big Clive over Patreon and quite a number of other YouTubers. So, you know, the principle of paying is not the thing. It's just the nonsense of, you know, you got to pay. And by the way, see this, we've got a big stick we're going to come and hit you over the head with, and you could end up in jail and all that stuff.
I know, it really
annoys me.
I'm actually, I've had this debate with guys in work and about, right, our life would be a lot simpler if we could just provide, you know, this concept of now when in the US you need to be on HBO for this and Disney for that and iTunes for that and somewhere else for something else, you know, just apply I know you're going to not like this, JWP, but if you applied a one pool of stuff, and in a similar way to the way record royalties get paid out on the radio, although, yes, asterisk, I do know about the issues with that, that you could fund niche products. You could fund additional, and it wouldn't actually matter if you got the distribution method, wouldn't matter, because then it would not be illegal for you to download something via torrent or some program via wherever, because the royalties for that would already be paid for by the tax that you have. We had a similar thing here in the Netherlands where you paid a tax on your, when you bought a cassette tape or a DVD, you paid an additional tax and then that got divided out proportionally to the artists. So you were allowed to make copies of music without any problem. Of course, now they have a problem with that, but there you go. That was then, this is now. Shall we read a few of these comments or will we skip over them?
I'm easy, really.
I'll do yours there. I see your
I
point,
like Frank.
Frank's
comment.
How about sorry, you read your own comment, David?
Oh, I'll read it. Yeah, sorry.
Frank's comment. Yeah.
Let me read my own comment, and then somebody else can do the next. I see your point. This is to Frank. Hi, Frank. I see where you're coming from, but although dealing with bureaucracy like this today seems like a scene from Terry Gilliam's film Brazil, the tyranny of modern advertising seems to me to be completely horrific. As a boy, I read the science fiction story The Tunnel Under the World by Frederick Pohl. In it, the protagonist finds himself in a world filled with loud, all-pervasive advertising jingles. And I give a link. This image, that image has stuck with me all of my life and has motivated me to avoid the dreadfulness of advertising in all of its forms on TV, cinemas, internet, and everywhere else I can.
And Biza said, TV detectors, the almost mythical TV detector vans did once exist. Not many people ever saw one. They could detect interference sent out by the electromagnetics on the CRT, but contrary to the propaganda, they could never tell the channel you were watching. If you lived in a block of flats, they were all but useless at working out who did and did not have a TV. When home computers became commonplace, each had a big CRT, the TV detectors were scuppered as they couldn't tell the difference between a TV and PC. Now we can have LED or LCD screens for our TVs and computers, and the concept of a reliable detector devices able to distinguish between the two is outdated. The UK TV Licensing Authority's reliance on cross-referencing addresses with license registrations to detect possible miscreants. That's what you are, Dave.
A possible, well, yeah, everybody is a possible miscreant.
Yeah, and then the Tony Hughes responded to, and he said, "Hi, Dave. Thanks for the show. It makes me think you think I should do one about the situation he's having with Virgin Media at the moment. I get total frustration, potentially boiling over to anger sometimes after you've had to wait 4 or 5 minutes to get through an auto menu to speak in human, only to be asked the same questions again. And they wonder why we hate customer service desk so much. More like customer wind-up desk, I think." End of comment 4.
So I'll read my last one, shall I? Thanks for the input. Yep. I said, "Hi, Biza. I'd enjoy seeing a TV detector van, but as you say, they belong to an earlier time. Funnily enough, the old TV I threw away was potential detector fodder, being a CRT. Your analysis of the situation clarifies it very well. Talk of detectors was mainly propaganda." And, "Hi, Tony, good luck with Virgin Media. It seems that the vast majority of companies have implemented such revolting front-end systems these days. As an aside, I long ago decided not to have anything to do with Virgin Media after they were revealed as being involved with a company called Form to perform deep inspection of internet traffic so they could inject targeted advertisement. Other UK ISPs were also involved, such as BT and TalkTalk." I'll give a link to the Form thing, which was a court case about it, I think, in the UK, which stopped it.
Once onto a call center, and I asked them, every time I asked them, well, why do you need this information again if we already had it in the at the beginning? And the only logical answer I got at the time from one guy was, "That's because we need to verify the details that you put in." And I went, "Well, if you did that, then why would you need it?" And he goes, "Yeah, it's auto dialers who will dial in randomly at the beginning. We are required to reconfirm to make sure that your details are valid and it's not somebody dialing up spoofing." So don't know how much credence I get to that.
Yeah. So why not just drop the robot then? I don't know. It seems
well, I always thought it was just to get the information about the person on the screen. So when I dial up, the information is available on the screen, and then I ask you, the person on. But it kind of doesn't make a lot of sense, really, because okay.
No. Well, anyway, that's my personal rant over. So we'll.
What's a night for rants?
One cool down.
The following day, we had managing your Android with AirDroid, which is from Frank Bell. It's a little application to manage your Android from AirDroid. "Hi, Frank. Thanks for reminding me about this application. I've used it in the past," this is Tony Hughes, "to transfer and manage data on my mobile, but as it's something I need to do regularly, I'd forgotten about it. Definitely something that is useful if sometimes a bit fiddly to get going initially."
And Frank says, "You are most welcome." Sorry, JWP, do you want to do it?
You can go ahead.
Okay. There's a bit of delay on your line, so sorry if I jumped in too quickly. Okay. "You're most welcome," he says. "The main irritant I've encountered is that after a reboot, it reverts to the default copy to directly, whereas I want to put my podcast in the music directory so the player application sees them easily. Once I got into the habit of double-checking the copy to directory setting, I kept it whipped into shape. I must say the maintainers have improved it over the several years I've been using it. Sounds like a cool tool, actually. I've been using KDE Connect, which is doesn't have as many features. It's quite nice. Has some interesting stuff, but this sounds better in some respects.
I've tried to use KDE Connect, but with my particular choice of having a wireless network separated from my wired network, it never really works out quite well for me.
Mm, yeah, I run Debian testing, so things suddenly stop working, and KDE Connect was one of them, unfortunately. I dare say it'll come back again.
Biza did a show about rolling out radio-based internet service to rural England, and this was inspired by my show, actually, just putting a microphone in front of somebody, about the Barn initiative where they're rolling out fiber. Tony Hughes commented saying, rolling out radio-based internet services in rural England. Hi, BZ. This was a great show. I'm glad you decided to come back and record again. You made some interesting comments about the way we have a free market after many years of a monopoly in telecoms here in the UK, which provides good value for the majority, but works against those that do not make a profitable market for the suppliers of internet services. Just a thought, but did you investigate satellite internet? I looked it up and it is expensive and seems to have quite strict data caps, but could be another way of getting service if other options are not available.
Frank says, this sounds very like the type of connection my brother has. He lives in a sparsely populated part of northeastern Virginia, USA. He tells me that it's vulnerable to the vagaries of the weather, as he's lost his connection several times due to thunderstorms. And he gives a pointer to the service.
Comment three is Biza answering, and he says, hi, Tony. Before my initial chance encounter with a radio-based system, I did look at satellite services, but they were seriously expensive, even before setting a download limit I can live with. That was around 2014, and I believe they have got a bit cheaper since then, but they remain the last resort option for all but the deepest pockets. Then he answered, Frank, I can only speak from my own experience, but since the system was installed, we've had winds of greater than 70 mile an hour, thick fogs, thunder, and no shortage of heavy rain, but the connection has been unaffected as far as I can determine. The network nodes all transmit with a multiple of the minimum power theoretically required to provide the service, and that enables signal to blast through bad weather. Perhaps where your brother lives, it's a greater distance between nodes and which weakens the signal. I've just returned from Spain, where they've noted a large number of internet transceivers mounted on houses and apartments, and I've since discovered that outside urban areas is pretty much the default delivery method.
This is very cool, I thought, this show. The fact that he'd actually managed to cause this to happen for his village and surrounding area was very, very impressive.
Yeah,
indeed.
Very, very, very cool. The following day, we had making bramble jelly or jam, and this was Tony. There were two comments to the show and by Tony himself. Hi, sorry, I meant to say that if you have a jam thermometer, you can use it to find the jam jelly point. But I use visual clues such as the rolling boil into small bubbles. Also, it stands to reason that if sterilizing the jug in the oven, it needs to be a heatproof one. Otherwise, use boiling water just before using.
I just commented, because Tony done this in a comment, I wrote back to him as a comment saying, I adjusted your original text regarding temperature in line with your comment and left an editor's note. You can also contact admin at Hacker Public Radio if you need errors fixed. So that seems
yeah,
to
good point.
To
work.
I thought that the show notes for this show were excellent, and that I always tease my wife because it's just me and her living in the house now, and she uses a really big pot. But Tony's pot, man, that makes my wife's pot look like a small. Tony, what are you going to do with all that jam in that big pot, brother? That's what I want to know, man. Golly, look at that pot, man. It's huge, man.
Yeah. Just think how many blackberries he's picked, and the number of jars of jelly he's going to get out of that.
He must have walked through sticker bushes a long time to find that, man.
Yeah, very impressive, actually. Very.
It was
impressive.
80-something jars of jam, wasn't it?
Did he say? I didn't.
Yeah, I think so.
Didn't catch it. Yeah, 60. I see it now. Produced over 60 jars of Ramblin'. That's amazing. That's a lot.
I guess he can get, he doesn't have to worry about what he's doing for Christmas gifts this year.
Nah, that's really impressive. And by the way, you know, the Americans tend to call what we call jam jelly, but we call this one jelly because it's had all of the bits strained out of it. So there's the difference between bramble jam and bramble jelly. Just thought you'd like to know that.
Ah, that's why he's using the two.
I always thought that the difference between jam and jelly was if you were in the north or if you were in the south. So lots of people call jam in the south, and lots of people say jelly up north. So yeah, I didn't know there was a difference. But in the UK, there is a physical difference, I guess. Jam has stuff in it, and jelly doesn't.
That's right. Yeah, my mum used to make tons of jam as well. She'd have had a great time talking to Tony if Steve was still alive. But and it was bramble jelly was one of her favourites.
So the next day we had Mr. X with how I create and post a show to HPR. We were at a little bit of a dip, and a lot of people came up and did shows. And this was a great walk through. The only comment I would have on this is that yes, your email is public. So the email that you use is a public email address, and it is displayed everywhere on the site with spam.spam. No spam at no spam replace. So in my case, it's ken@fallon.ie is ken.nospam@nospam.fallon.ie. But other than that, it seems to work okay. Were you able to follow it? But I guess you post shows quite a lot, so...
Yeah, I thought he did a nice job of explaining things here. It was good to hear somebody sort of talking their way through this sort of thing. Reading the text can sometimes overwhelm you a bit, I think. So this is good.
Yeah, especially I think that the upload process is perfect, given the fact that I did it. So what makes logical sense to me does not necessarily make logical sense to everybody else, has been my experience. So if anyone ever has any comments about the upload process and how to make it easier, then please feel free to get in touch with me. And every cloud has a silver lining. Short, somewhat rhyming thoughts provoked by emptying the show queue, The only problem about this is we don't have the text. I would love to have the text of this and have it on the about page.
Yes, that was what I said as well to myself in my notes here. What a lovely thing. Have we had many poems? Because that was definitely a poem. That was brilliant.
That was awesome. That just made me chuckle. That just was awesome. Made my day, that did. I listened to it a few times, actually.
Yeah. It brought such a smile to my face that it's just a real gem.
And also nailed the whole thing about HPR, what we are, what we're trying to do. For some reason, the site seems a bit slow right now. And then the next day we had NY Bill, who may or may not have a problem, depending on your point of view, Little Meters, two multimeters from Banggood. And he threatens to stop buying meters, but Mike Gray came in there going, no, don't stop buying and reviewing meters. It's a great show. I love the sound of the bench, Bill ripping open little bags of probes, checking battery compartments, slapping in batteries, dropping the meter, the sounds of NY in the background, an audio feast. Please don't stop buying meters.
Dave Lee says, excellent show. Really enjoyed this. I'd love to know more about the oscilloscope in the photo. More miniature geekery. Oh, and I'm likely to buy the 8008 multimeter.
As am I.
And comment three was by NY Bill. He says, ambient noise. Thanks, Mike. You know, I didn't notice any of the outside noises while I was recording. Only after I did notice them in Audacity. I just wish I remembered to plug in the mic, the windscreen. I don't like hearing the mic clip in the wind.
And NY Bill comment said, it'll... 08. Thanks, Dave. Yeah, it seems like a capable little meter for the price. It's been my regular small set of tools in the laptop bag ever since the show. High praise indeed, folks.
Mike Gray returns to say ASMR, ambient noise and ASMR. Don't worry about the ambient noise. It was not intrusive. I think near the end there, the usual burst of distant police stroke ambulance siren, which any city dweller can tune out. But that was not loud. The day after this podcast and drooling over the sounds of beeps, clicks, tools, battery manipulations, etc., which let me visualize the workbench so vividly, I heard mention of something called ASMR, Automatic Sensory Meridian Response, for which a lot of stuff is appearing on YouTube these days, nowadays. It's sometimes that it sounds that generate a response that feels like a pleasurable tingle of tingling of the scalp, down the spine, etc. The stuff on YouTube is all typified by women whispering, turning the pages of a book, drumming fingernails and stuff like that. But the workshop sounds and the infectious enthusiasm in your podcast qualifies. Maybe I'm more subject to this kind of stuff because I'm blind. No idea, but the sound effects were great.
Okay, and then comment 6 by NY Bill. I meant to reply to the scope of the comment, Dave, but I was typing above the replies and the first thing in the morning when I should have been driving to work. Yeah, I don't think I mentioned that scope in the past episodes. I've had it for a couple of years now, and it could warrant a little review. You've been a bit of kin in you trying to pull another show out of people. Mike sounds like you heard outside my window, which I hear as type are New York. I'm not in New York City, but I'm in the suburbs of a city a little more north. And then he gives the wink sign.
And that's it for the comments on this show. Sorry, do you want to say something?
Oh, I just wanted to comment on the show and say I did enjoy it very much, as always, with NY Bill. And those multimeters look good. The 8008 is highly, highly desirable, I'd say.
I ended up just buying a cheap multimeter for work because I now find it so frustrating not having a multimeter. It's a funny thing, if the more you mess with electronics, the more you need a multimeter at your hand all the time. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
I just went to the Balmart and I bought a multimeter. We didn't have one. My Surefire was messing up. I don't know if you know about Surefires, Ken, but my Surefire was messing up. And the batteries are really expensive for the Surefire, and I just couldn't figure out what was wrong. And I just said, well, you know what I need? I need a multimeter. And I went and I tested all my batteries in my pack, and I tested the bulb, and I did all kinds of stuff. And I finally figured out what was wrong with the flashlight. But in order to do that, I had to have a multimeter.
Yeah, exactly. So now we're moving on to comments related to previous shows, and the first one is about show finishing off the subject of Bash expansion part 1, which was a show by you, and comment number 9 has recently been left by Clucky. On the topic of LS, there's a new player and some people say it's both faster. I'm assured it's statting less eagerly than Core Util LS does. And more featureful, more coloring info on Git things, more tree visualization. I haven't tried it myself yet. The website is https://they.exa.website. Also, it's written in Rust, but that's the least interesting property of it.
John Culp says, awkward, that EXA command does look pretty cool and powerful, but it's way too awkward to type. I would have to make an alias for it, maybe even a linked LS to it. I should have done mine as well. Should have let somebody else do that. Shall I do mine? Not sure about, I tended to call it EXA, but I don't know what it's really supposed to be called. Perhaps it's too new, but EXA doesn't seem quite the tool for me. Firstly, I couldn't find out what the colors and underlines actually mean. Secondly, I found I need to change the screen background color and font to be able to read the colored text. Admittedly, it might be my eyes, but if a file name is basically a blur, I don't get a lot from the feature. I have similar problems with other commands that generate colored output, so I don't blame EXA. Potentially the Git interface is useful, though I don't know what the symbols mean. The whole thing needs documentation, ideally in the form of a well-structured man page. Also, I was puzzled to find out that EXA space minus L minus minus git db underscore star, which is some files of mine, didn't show the Git details for the matching files. These are only shown when there's no file argument. My final nitpick is that my favorite LS minus LTR can't be written so simply in EXA. The equivalent seems to be EXA space minus LS space modify. I'd like to see a way of setting defaults like sort of sort by modification time, though an environment variable or a configuration file, something like that. As John says, using aliases would also be a solution. I should be intrigued to see how EXA develops. It does have promise. Thanks for alerting me to it, Klecky. So I'm whinging there a bit. I should shut up.
No, it's,
I think it's a bit dangerous. If something comes along and replaces LS, there will be an awful lot of bash scripts needing to be rewritten, that's for sure.
Yeah. Although they do say a bash script with LS in it is a bad bash script.
Well, then all my bash scripts are very bad bash scripts.
Yeah. I've taken that lesson on and been changing a number of mine, I have to say. I should do a show on this, shouldn't I? Yeah.
Yes, you should. There is a comment on the MX Linux, which was a show by Tony. And he just commented to say the JWP had made a comment to say, wow, you seem to find something here for the room. Maybe this had something to do with the old MEPIS project at some point. And he replies, thanks, JWP. Yes, MX is anti-X and MEPIS community respin. I tried anti-X and it's very lean, even compared with MX. Makes sense.
And Ken, MX was, if you're a Debian person, MX was the thinnest of the thinnest of the thin. You couldn't get much thinner than MX. It was really, really interesting.
That sounds like a show to me, Dave.
Indeed. Yes, I think we need to know more.
Yeah, I don't even know if MX is still going on. I don't think I have anything to run MX on. I'd probably have to get VirtualBox to give it a try again. But if you're a Debian person, MX was really, really interesting because it was the pure Debian, but the one that didn't have sudo on it, any of that. Interestingly enough, I use SUSE. I did that OpenSUSE thing, and I can do sudo just like I can on Ubuntu, and I can use apt and all of the stuff on SUSE just like I do on Ubuntu. I didn't know that it used to be not possible. So it's built in. I just typed it in the way that it would on the SUSE. So I used apt-get update and upgrade and did all my Ubuntu Debian commands on SUSE, and it works out of the box. No extra config.
Interesting. One last comment. Geddes replied to his own show, the last of his show in the series about the Cadian Live Part 6 workflow and conclusion. And he says, thanks to everybody, particularly HBR community news hosts, for their complimentary comments. I enjoyed everything involved with narrating and producing this series. Learned a hell of a lot in the process. Discovering as I went along that I was entering a world of the voiceover artist. Your comments, Ken, on Creative Commons last month, I felt were spot on, and I'm happy to make a contribution to CC community via HBR. Yes, you have. Yes, you have, Gideon. Thank you very much indeed for that. Dave, we have comments from... Why are the comments green, Dave? Remind me again.
Yes. The green ones, which will not be green when these notes go live, were for us as a hint to say that we'd already covered those comments last time.
Well, it needed to be said again, Dave.
This is why I let you go on with it.
Why do I always do that jump after?
Well, it's so clear, isn't it? Green comments shouldn't be read. Everybody knows that.
Yes. There are two comments on the community news for June 2017, and Clacky says the hitch prep tag, you said half jokingly, but my idea is that every post in Clacky's HBR EP, HBR, not hitch prep tag, HBR EP tag, is a full and earnest public commitment to making a real episode. This is because he has a whole public website about available where you can see the shows he's working on, which actually might be a good idea.
I think it's a great idea, yes. But he thought we were sort of joking about it rather than otherwise. So I commented back saying it's a while ago now, because this is the June episode that this was a comment on. It's a while ago now, and my memory's not what it was, but I think we were marveling at your preparedness to go public with your plans. I, for one, am looking forward to hearing these episodes. No joke.
Indeed. And on Christopher M. Hobbs repairing a garage door fail. We had Windigo who's saying, "Phew, I kept expecting a message on the end of the episode saying that it was uploaded posthumously." Can I get a spell check there on Niall Moore, please?
Most people pronounce that posthumously.
That's what I would pronounce as well if I wasn't tired. "Glad to hear things are okay. I thoroughly enjoyed listening, even if the problem wasn't solved. I had never given my garage door any thought, and I'm glad to know more about how it works." I actually like these shows because it means that when somebody comes back and gets it fixed, I get two episodes.
Yes, yes. I'd like to have seen some pictures of that garage door because I'm not clear how it works. Is it one of these sort of multi-part fold-over type things or an up and over single pivot one? I don't know. I need to know more.
But what's JWP doing posting shows while talking to us?
I did a show before the show.
Very good. That's my boy. That's multitasking.
I did a show before.
So
okay. That's a first.
That's the end of all the comments. And we now then go through the stuff on the mailing list. There's not too much. Bear with us. We're almost there. We're almost there. I updated the stats page by default. Everything remains the same, but now we support XML, JSON, and CSV. So stats.php, question format, JSON, question format equals XML, question format equals CSV, and you can get stuff out of that. The Ogbot, HPR Ogbot, HPR support has already been updated. Thanks, Crayon, on Ogcast Planet. So that's good.
Cool.
And remember, folks, this is your network. So if there's stuff that you want, if there's information you want out of the webpage, don't be going scraping. Contact us and we can make it available in a format that might be easier. We had Michael sending us in a comment to say the show 2017 was ongoing and that there was a phone-in number that you could use if you wished to do so. We've got nominated for the Podcast Awards, which is excellent, and for the second time in a row. And there are some requirements there. We need to submit an acceptance video, and we're looking for some help on doing that. I've just spoken to Klaatu has volunteered to help out with that request. So if you are willing to help us out with some with doing some segments of video, can you please contact us? And you can get in touch with Klaatu at the following email address, which is klaatu@members.fsf.org. Member.fsf.org. Klaatu@member.fsf.org. We had John the Nice Guy telling us about the Canterbury Ogcamp Festival, which some people went to. Without telling us,
yeah, it was great, Ken. I drank
to
so
all the
many
shows
beers.
Recorded.
I just did a show about it.
Excellent, good man.
Yeah, good. I did a show about it. But Richard Brown, what I'm trying to do is, so Richard, he goes and does shows all the time, right? He talks, and I've been trying to get Richard. You know, he's the chairperson for OpenSUSE, not the community manager, but the chairperson now.
Okay, yeah.
And when he does all of his shows, because he's taking on Container as a Service, the open version of that, and he's also, I think for the next year, still going to be the chair guy. And so he does a lot of traveling, does a lot of shows, and I asked him, I said, "Hey, if there's any way at all that when you get up, just press the record button on your laptop, and you know, we could get the audio from whatever it is that you're talking with, whatever group, and put it on Hacker Public Radio." And he was down with that. He said he's drank beer with you before, Ken, that he knows you, and that he's going to do that. I'm going to see him. I'm going to the SUSEcon last week in September in Prague, and I'm going to see him there, and I'll remind him that we're supposed to do he's supposed to record. So I know that he's going to do some presentations at SUSEcon, and hopefully we can get a couple of shows out of him that way.
Excellent. And that offer is, of course, open to anybody that any of the distributions or projects. Yeah.
Yeah, especially folks that travel a lot and give presentations anyway. Just press the
Press the record button, yeah. The Amateur Radio Roundtable, the next one, is going to be at a European-friendly time of 1800 UTC. The next one is proposed for the 13th of September, and the next one after that is the 15th of November, both of them at 1800 UTC. Be there or be a square. I think that is pretty much that. Do we have any other business, David?
Quickly, yes. Switching tabs. Yes.
Filling up hold the on queue. A second. I was looking at the queue. So we have the continuous leaky boat thing where we have no shows, then we're swamped with shows. We have no shows, we're swamped with shows. We do have scheduling guidelines on the web page, and they are as follows. You need to have your audio recorded before you pick a slot. So don't pick a slot and then come back. You need to have the audio recorded. The last thing you do is the upload. And these are how you should schedule the shows. Always try and fill any available slot in the upcoming week. So for the next 7 days, if there's a free slot, then fill that one. If the queue is filled up quite a bit, try and leave a few free slots for new contributors. If it's a non-urgent show, find an empty week and schedule them in there. If you're uploading a series or you're a host that of uploading multiple shows at the one time, try and space them out every 2 weeks or so. And the reason I'm putting that in is because we had no shows, and then suddenly now we're full for the next month or whatever. And then after that, we have no shows again. So as it's turned out, and there's one other rule that we don't have in there, but it should actually go in. If it's interviews that you've done, try and ignore all this, pick the next available slot, because it's just polite that if you've interviewed somebody that you want to get the show out as quickly as possible. So that's pretty much that. I was talking to you, Dave, thinking about whether we would we'll always have the option for people to pick the days just like they are now, but having a I don't care button that would implement these rules via an algorithm. So look at who you are as a host. If you're a new host, then you get the next free slot. If you've submitted shows recently, try and spread them out. If it's not an interview, if it's an interview, then schedule it immediately, stuff like that. What do you think?
I think it sounds like a good idea. I wonder about the implementation a bit, but the principle sounds pretty sound. Do you not think though that it will confuse people? One of the reasons why we ended up with the scheme that we have now was Klaatu who suggested it being like this in a general way, was because all of the previous thing was quite complex. Is that not right? Or is my memory failing me?
Yeah, exactly. And there's always the risk that you are biased towards that I would pick, put you before JWP or something, which I'm not going to do. However, you always, with this, I'm saying you still as a host have the option to pick the queue. And here I would suggest, because we're following a logic, which would be on the about page if you did do that, this is me thinking out loud here, that if, for example, you are a new host, it would go, well, I'm scheduling you on the first available slot, which was next Tuesday, because you are a new host. And if it was you uploaded an interview, I'm setting you the next available slot because this is an interview and interviews usually need to come out in a timely manner. But if it was, say, like you uploading a show, the second Vim show, for example, I would say, well, you have released the show. There's already been a show from you in this queue on this series, so I'm putting it another week out. Stuff like that.
Yeah. So
put the actual reason into the email confirmation that you get back.
Mm-hmm. The one comment that I might have, Ken, is a lot of times I'll make a, in January or late December, I'll make a a goal for the year, right? And, yeah. You know, one of my goals was to do a podcast every month. And so, you know, when I have time, I'll put one in November, December, you know, or whatever. But then if you reach a dry point, you go and grab my podcast so I don't get to be, don't have one every month anymore.
I only did that once, and I did that, JWP, because I knew, of course, I picked the wrong one.
I don't know, but I did another one for October because I didn't think I had one for October anymore. And I have to look and see if there's one in November or December for me. I think next year I'm going to try to do, I may up the ante and try to do 12 of greater than 15 minutes with great audio quality.
Ooh,
so that's a thing. But with the scheduling thing, I don't care button would be good. For some reason now, Audacity is not doing my tags. So I don't know why I'm using 1604 and it doesn't want to do my tags anymore. So I guess I got to get Easy Tag or something like that to come in and do it. But
The tags on the episodes, the metadata, you don't need to do that anymore.
Yeah.
That's all taken care of by Dave, his tool that we take when you fill out the upload form. What's in your upload form gets added automatically, so you don't need to worry about that. Don't worry about the intro and outro, that gets added automatically. You know that title that you fill in when you do the upload form? All of that gets put into the metadata as you're uploading.
So yeah.
We completely ignore it, actually.
I mean, I watched those guys from the Late Night Linux pod, and those guys, they really have some serious stuff to do their podcast with. I mean, it was, wow, I couldn't believe the kind of equipment that they had, that they were plugging into to do that stuff. So, one of the great things about HPR is that, you know, I'm hoping that we get more of a cross section of folks and most channels, other medium channels. I learned what bramble jelly was this month. I'm hoping that that other people. I may try to get my wife makes a pretty good bolognese sauce, and I may try to get her to talk about that bolognese sauce. I'm hoping that people would talk to their people in their house that make stuff like that and do that more. In particularly the jelly or something homemade. I thought your ironing board, Ken, was a great example of something that we really thought about something and did something. So stuff like that, it, you know, spices things up.
Patent pending ironing board modification, just so you know. Wow. All right, carrying on before we kill people here with the length of this episode. Tags and summaries, Dave, do you want to talk to us?
Yeah. It's just me using the Any Other Business slot to say thanks to people for sending in some tags. And we've had Epicanis and Windigo have sent some in. We're at 950 shows that need summaries and tags. So every little helps. So if you can contribute, we'd very much appreciate it.
I've not actually sent them in yet, so great.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, anything else that you missed? Or?
Did you want to say anything about the comment system here? Or
oh yes, I did.
What's
I did.
On the mailing list? Well, enough.
Do you want to comment about the comment system then?
It was merely people who haven't necessarily tracked the mailing list to say that we're grasping the nettle of the comment system and we're trying to rewrite it. With a new sort of homebrew one, which will be compliant with HTTPS, whereas the old one is not. And it's also been a pain for us for a long time.
Yeah, major pain.
So we'll sort of watch this space, and we'll be updating people as we go.
Yeah, the issue is the commenting system is a third-party component, and the guy who supports it hasn't updated his webpage in 2 years, and his demo site is also down, doesn't support HTTPS, which led to very interesting error messages and log files filling up in the back end, so we had to disable that. And now we get Google Chrome says that from next month, all websites will that are not HTTPS will be getting a warning in their menu bar. So that's not good if you go to a site called Hacker Public Radio and there's going to be a warning message. So we really need to get that fixed. It's basically been the kick in the butt for Dave and myself to actually do this. We've wanted to do it for a while, to be honest. I think you'd agree.
Absolutely. It was a good impetus to get moving with it. So, and we are... So we're making progress. But,
making headway.
It's a way to go. Yeah.
There will be the if you subscribe to the comment feed, the IDs changed today, so you'll get 30 new comments that you may have seen before. So that may continue for a week or two, but don't worry too much about it. It'll be fine. Nothing's going wrong. We're just messing with the comment system, and that should also have the effect of giving us ownership of the databases and stuff again, and all the code on there is now then owned by HPR and will be available at some sort of license at some time.
It does also, just one point, it does mean that if somebody makes a mess of a comment and says, oh help, I did this wrong, I made a spelling mistake, can you fix it for us, for me, then we can. Whereas with the old system, it did bizarre things if you tried to edit it.
Yeah,
and very strange. So that's going to be a possibility in the future.
One thing is now we do need to put in our own anti-spam measures, which I actually am thinking will be easier because people have been know that we're using this particular commenting system and will be exploiting it. One of the measures that we'll be doing will be asking questions on the... when you need to post a comment, you will be asked a question, nothing too serious. I don't know if it's going to be a maths question or something probably like... who was the host of this show? And then you scroll up to the top and you copy the host name and you paste it in. And that should pretty much work. Or possibly, what is the host ID number of the host of the show? And then you just hover over the link. Or if you're visually impaired, you click on the host name and then you will get the episode ID, the host ID from there. But we will talk to our... various different people. It might just be a question like, what does the H in HPR stand for? And we'll see how it goes from there. I'm gonna put in stuff like, I'm thinking if there are more than 10 comments in the queue, then I'm just going to shut down commenting until we see what's going on. Probably the safest thing to do for a start. What do you reckon, Dave?
Yeah. Wait and see if we do get hit with lots of spam. But yeah, having that as a way of turning the tab off would be good.
Yeah, I do that on the uploads at the minute, if because my experience has shown that, you know, we don't get that many uploads of a day. So if I suddenly start getting 20 uploads, then I freeze everything because, that's suspicious activity. So I'll probably do the same thing with the comments. So if you we'll play it according to, we'll play it. Play it by ear, basically, but we're basically replacing the comment system. There you go. That's it. Right now, we have the comment feed has been updated and the comment viewer has been updated. And I'm currently working on the form to create them has been done. And I know we're just going to write them to a JSON file on the server, and then Dave's going to pick them up from another machine and process them. And then if they pass his stringent anti-spam measures, then he'll add them to the database. Pretty much it.
That's it. Yep.
So, anything else, folks?
Is it a wrap?
Tune in tomorrow for another exciting episode of
Hacker.
Hacker Public Radio. Public
Radio. Oh, join us now and share the software. You'll be free, hackers. You'll be free. Hallelujah. Join us now and share the software. You'll be free. You'll be free. That was one seriously far too long episode, guys. Good night.
Good night.
Good night, guys. Good night. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.